Welcome to another episode of Islam in Focus. This is going to be our fifth episode on Islamic teachings and Islamic dictates, and more specifically, it's going to be our fourth episode on the concept of monotheism and God, or God, capital G, Allah, in Islam. Our guest today is Dr. Jamal Badawi, and assalamu alaikum, Dr. Jamal, welcome to our program. I was wondering if you could give us a very close capsule comment or capsule summary of our last episode.
Okay, last time we were continuing with the explanation of the Muslim creed, which says basically there is no deity but Allah, God, capital G, and Muhammad is his messenger. We explained also that Allah is the Arabic term for God, capital G, as the sole creator and sustainer of the universe. We discussed briefly or continued the discussion as to why the Islamic creed starts with negation rather than affirmation, and we tried to indicate that there have been lots of human errors throughout history in trying to have this proper knowledge about God, and as such it's very important to point out to this shortcoming so that we don't fall or lapse into them again. And so far we have discussed six specific types of negations. First was idolatry or worship of idols, worship of forces of nature like stars, the moon, the sun. Three, polytheism or several gods, believe in several gods. Fourthly was the dualism or believe in one god for good and one for evil. Fifthly, we discussed the worship of other beings like spirits, Satan worship, or worship even of magicians and people who practice sorcery. And sixthly, the last negation we discussed was the worship of other human beings, whether because they are ancestors or worship of other people who were pious people, great holy men, or even in some cases great prophets and messengers. And we try to indicate that all the great messengers of Allah are to be proud to be servants of Allah. Mm-hmm. That includes all the great prophets, especially Noah, Abraham, Moses, Jesus, and Muhammad, that all of them should really feel proud rather than being demoted when they are true servants of Allah. And we try finally to clarify that all these forms of worship or interceding gods, if you will, are forms which are not quite consistent with the Islamic pure monotheism.
Right. Now, the word worship, as we've used it so far, was worship in the sense of deification. Is there another sense that worship may be taken to mean, or sort of another meaning to the word worship in an Islamic context?
This is an interesting question, because in fact you could have a whole series on the concept of worship in Islam. What does it really mean? But to limit myself to specifically your question as it relates to worship of other human beings, according to Islam, blind obedience to other human beings, the refraining from using our Allah-given intellect and human faculties in searching for the truth, is some kind of form of worship of those individuals. Perhaps I could illustrate this by a little story that happened 1400 years ago during the lifetime of Prophet Muhammad. At that time, one passage was revealed in the Quran, namely 9:31, chapter 9, verse 31. Mm-hmm. And that passage reads, talking about people who followed their religious leaders prior to Islam, they have taken as lords besides Allah their clergy, that's priests and anchorites. So one of the companions of the Prophet by the name of Adi ibn Hatim, who had some knowledge or background about Christianity came to the Prophet, yeah, and he came to him and he said, "Oh, Messenger of Allah, it is not true that those people really worship their priests or anchorites or clergy." So the Prophet asked him, he said, "Didn't some of those religious leaders make unlawful things that God made lawful?" He said, "Yes." He said, "Right. Didn't they take authority by also making lawful things which God made unlawful?" He said, "Yes." He said, "Well, that's their worship," which really conveyed the message that you don't have to bow down before a human being to be called that you're worshiping him or defying him. But this blind obedience, this, like I said, limiting one's use of God-given capability of intelligence, of thinking, of searching, is one form, actually, of worshipping of those individuals. And interesting enough, you might say that this story is only 1,400 years old. It's too remote back in history. But I consider it very relevant to our today's generation and problems.
It hasn't stopped them either.
No.
Yeah. Now, how about obedience to a dictator, let's say? Would this still come under the concept of worship?
Well, it would still fall under the worship of other human beings. Indeed, some people misunderstand or misinterpret the various liberation movements that took place, for example, throughout the history of Islam. And many times they try to separate between what might be considered as social reform or political uprising on one hand versus just purely religiously motivated type of uprisings. And the fact of the matter, as far as Islam is concerned, is that obedience again to dictators, just like obedience to clergy or anybody else without thinking, constitute a form of human worship. And this type of obedience is a kind of acceptance of the authority of dictators above the authority of God. Like I might have indicated before, in Islam there is nothing called one compartment that you should render unto Caesar, another compartment that you should render unto God. Everything should be rendered unto God, unto Allah, the Creator. This kind of struggle that you find in the history of the Muslim people against dictatorship, past and present, is a continuous, is ongoing process which actually is based on Quranic injunctions even. More specifically, in the Quran we read in chapter 5, verses 47 through 50, that those who do not rule in accordance with what Allah has revealed are regarded as unbelievers in one passage, as oppressors in another passage, as rebels in the third passage. And it is interesting to notice that this passage in the Quran, it simply says whoever does not rule in accordance with what Allah has revealed, it does not exempt even a Muslim. In other words, a person may pay lip service to faith, a person may claim to be even a Muslim as a ruler, whereas his acts, his behaviors are contrary to Islam, are contrary to the revelation of Allah. So even that person, even though he might nominally be called a Muslim, would definitely be going against that. And that's the case, quite frankly, with the majority of rulers in Muslim countries today, whether they have the titles of kings or sheikhs or presidents, just titles to mislead people. And indeed, in many cases, it's totalitarian regime, it's dictatorship, contrary to the Islamic injunctions and system of government.
Yeah. Okay, so far we have been limiting the concept of worship to worshipping extra-personal beings or phenomena. How about worshipping oneself, in other terms, self-worship, vanity and pride? How does Islam view
that? You'd be pleased to know that even that was not left out in the comprehensive coverage of this aspect of monotheism in the Quran. It is regarded, actually, like you said, as worship of other mortals. It might take a variety of forms. Let me focus on two. In some cases, it may even take the form of self-deification. The Quran, for example, narrates the story of the pharaohs during the time of Prophet Moses, may peace be with him. When, as the Quran says in chapter 79, verses 23 and 24, that the Pharaoh collected his men or his people and made a proclamation saying, "I am your Lord, Most High." This is perhaps the utmost of human arrogance that a human being claims to be the final and the ultimate authority to say what is to be done or what is not to be done. But self-worship also takes another subtle form, a hidden form that most of us would fall into in some form or the other, but perhaps to a different degree. And that is when we take our own desires and our own opinions and place that as the ultimate source of guidance, the ultimate source of values to guide us in our lives, even though it may contradict with clear and decisive divine injunctions. In fact, there is a specific, more than one verse, but I just quote one verse or passage in the Quran that deals with that particular issue. In 25:43, it says, "Have you seen him who takes his or her low desires or whims for his or her God? Will you be a guardian over him or her?" In other words, it's just regarded the term used in the Quran, ilahahu, his God or his Lord. So instead of saying Allah or God is my Lord, I say my desires, what I want, what I think is right, is my ultimate source. I put aside whatever revelation says. In my humble opinion, I consider this form of adoration or self-worship as one of the most serious aberrations in our age. Many times we are tempted to say, well, material is everything. Let's put aside spiritual, moral teachings, divine revelation. Let's just put it on the side as far as it serves my objective. I can use it. If not, I just put it aside. And we normally hear that statement made quite frequently. I know what's good for me. I know what's best for me. Sometimes even we go against the clear and decisive injunction of Allah. Even when we destroy ourselves, drinking, drugs, and all other aberrations, and still destroy ourselves, say, I know what's good for me, what's best for me. Again, like I said, placing what we think is right, what we think is good,
as a supreme arbiter,
as the supreme and above what God himself tell us what should be.
Okay, in the negation part of our creed, I think there is one concept still left, albeit a little bit esoteric, but I think it should be included here, and we should mention something about it, and that is the concept of pantheism, where God exists in everything and everywhere. How does Islam view that idea?
I think this kind of argument mixes as a philosophy between two different things.
Mm-hmm.
On one hand, to say that we can see the power of God, we can see in a metaphoric sense, allegorically, the hands of God and his compassion, and by looking into the creation which he has created, is one aspect. And to argue that because God created everything and his power is manifested in everything, then God must be inside or in or incarnated in everything. I think these two should not be mixed. From the Muslim standpoint, and this relates to one of the earlier series, that we said that the Quran implores us, encourages us indeed, to look into ourselves, to look into our environment, to look into the universe at large. And by finding the functioning and operation of all of these things, we are bound to find out that there must be a designer, must be a compassionate, all-powerful creator behind all that. But this doesn't mean that he is in the sun, or he is in the moon, or in other human beings. This kind of aberration is simply carrying the powers of God, or carrying the argument too far, in some kind of extreme, which is not acceptable to me.
Great. So I think that takes care of the negative part of our creed, and it's time now to start looking at the affirmative attributes of Allah from an Islamic standpoint. And I was wondering if one could possibly define Allah, so to speak, if the term applies.
Well,
from an Islamic standpoint,
there's a problem when you use the term define, because anything that is definable by definition must be limited, must be finite.
That's right.
Allah or God is infinite, then you could not be subject to any definition, because definition is limited.
Limitation.
To define something, it's to establish limitation. A limitation, and God is beyond limitation. This is one thing. But the problem perhaps could be addressed by making a distinction between two things again. On one hand, the essence or nature of Allah or God,
mm-hmm.
and secondly, the attributes, divine attributes of Allah. Now, let me explain what I mean by that. When we talk about the essence of Allah, the nature of Allah, we can say that his nature or his essence is so sublime, so transcendent, that our human mind, no matter how intelligent it may be, is incapable of totally grasping his essence,
yeah.
or his nature. However, as far as attributes of Allah or attributes of God, these are or could be within reasonable reach, within at least reasonable understanding as far as our human comprehension goes. And I say relatively because, again, when you talk about attributes of the infinite, you can't really separate attributes totally from the essence, but at least the
right.
conceptual distinction could be quite useful. Sometimes people would wonder, how could we fail to understand the essence of God and only know about his attributes or manifestations of power? But what we forget when we make this argument is that even in physical, tangible things, sometimes you are not really able to define their essence. Electricity, atomic energy, many others.
Yeah.
You can explain a great deal about electricity, how it works, or atomic energy, but can you really describe the essence of electricity? The essence of atomic energy.
Mm-hmm.
So we can't even reach that. A human being. You can't describe a human being, say he's that tall, that big, he weighs that much, his face looks this or that. Fine. But can you, even with the best knowledge of psychology and psychiatry, understand the essence of a human being? Can you understand your own essence as a human being?
Right.
So what I'm saying here is that even in physical and tangible things in this universe, we are not capable to penetrate our understanding to understand fully their essence. How about understanding the essence of the supreme being, of the infinite?
Becomes a metaphysical problem.
It becomes a very difficult problem to materialize.
As a matter of fact, even when we limit ourselves to using attributes rather than the essence, we found ourselves faced with another problem, and I was wondering if you could comment on that. And the problem is, if we talk about Allah being finite ourselves and being limited ourselves and being relative ourselves, we have to use relative terms, terms that are understandable within our own vocabulary, so to speak. So we start using terms that have human connotations. How do we reconcile those two when we see that God sees, God hears? These are all terms that we understand very much in our own human
perception.
Context or perception.
Right.
How do we bridge that gap when we start using
right.
those terms in reference to Allah?
I think you're quite right when you pointed to the fact that no word, no in any human language, Arabic, English, whatever, can really be totally accurate in conveying something even about the attributes of deity, of Allah.
Mm-hmm.
However, in his infinite mercy, Allah has communicated with us in a way that we could understand. So, like he said, again, using terms which might not have exactly the same human or material meaning, but it would be useful, though, that these terms are used to give us some understanding or some perception about God, not of God, about God himself. However, we find that the Quran also warns us, that God himself, in his own words, in the Quran, warns us against taking these words in a very literal or very physical meaning that we understand as human beings. Perhaps to make the point less abstract, let me give a few citations from the Quran that mm-hmm. illustrate the point. The first one, لَيْسَ كَمِثْلِهِ شَيْءٍ. That is, there is nothing, whatever, like unto him, God. And he is the one that hears and sees all things. That's in mm-hmm. chapter 42, verse 11. In another moving passage, 6:103, no vision can grasp him, but he grasps, or his grasp is over all vision. He is above all comprehension, yet is acquainted with all things. And maybe I can repeat one citation that was made in a previous program, because again, it's very crucial, the very famous chapter 112 of the Quran towards the end. Say, O Muhammad, to people, He is Allah, the one and only. Allah, the eternal, the absolute. He begets not, nor is He begotten. And notice the last verse. And there is none like unto Him. Nothing comparable, no peer. So whenever we use the term, for example, like God or Allah hears and sees, it doesn't mean that He needs eyes to see with. It doesn't need ears to hear with.
Mm-hmm.
Even we as human beings, sometimes you don't see all the time with your eyes. If I ask you to close your eye for a second and just imagine the shape of your TV sets or your couch, you can see it even while you're closing your eyes.
Right.
You see it in your own imagination.
Right.
So even as humans, you don't see everything with eye. But of course, when you talk about Allah or God, we're not really making comparison. We're simply saying that He does not need the physical or biological organs in order to be able to see or hear.
Now, it's clear that we are trying to put or emphasize the dissimilarity between God and His creatures, which brings us to a touchy question, a very relevant and important one, however, and that is, how does the Muslim reconcile himself or view the biblical statement referring to God having created man in His own image? How do we view that statement? How do we actually understand it, accept it, or lack of acceptance, whatever?
You're referring to the first chapter in Genesis which
right.
says that God said, let's create man in our image after our likeness.
Right.
That's what you're referring
right.
to. Well, a Muslim sees two problems with this type of statements or any similar statement like that. First of all, that as we indicated before, Allah, or God, capital G, does not have any image because He's not physical. And as was cited before, لَيْسَ كَمِثْلِهِ شَيْءٍ. There is nothing whatsoever that you could think of or you know or you experience which is comparable to Allah. Because if it's comparable to anything that's physical or material, then He's limited, He's finite. This is one thing to keep in mind. So from the Muslim standpoint, it is erroneous to reduce the infinite to any finite form, including even finite type of image. A result of this, or the way people interpreted this kind of biblical statement, has been throughout history to imagine or make a drawing, make a picture of God, if you will, in a human form.
Mm-hmm.
In a recent issue of the Time magazine, dealing again with the new theological arguments about God, The magazine reproduced four pictures that people imagined as belonging to God, mostly Christian artists, including Michelangelo.
The Sistine Chapel.
Right, exactly. Yeah. And in all of them, invariably, it's a figure of, or a face of a man, a relatively older man, you know, with beard, and the shape would vary, but it's basically an image of a man, because again, apparently these people would go back and read the Genesis and say, all right, God created man in His own likeness or in His own image, so God must look like a physical. This is not acceptable to the Muslim. In fact, this kind of configuration of deity, of Allah, raises a number of questions. When you look at this picture in the Time, for example, you're entitled to ask a number of questions. Number one, why a picture of a man, not a woman?
Right.
All of them have beards, so no way that you could say it's a woman.
Yeah.
Why a picture of a white, not a black, for example, or yellow?
Right.
Why that picture shows a feature of a face which is mostly Greco-Roman rather than Chinese, Japanese, African, or someone else?
Mm-hmm.
See, you open a whole can of worms once you reduce God to a certain image which is quite limited by its very nature.
Mm-hmm.
Fortunately for the Muslim, this problem never arises. Many of my Christian friends, for example, ask me, okay, when you think about Allah or God, capital G, do you have any mental picture of him, something similar to this painting? I said, no, I need not. Right. The spiritual image is much more valuable, more important, and more befitting. Again, I'm using image again in a very allegorical sense, not that you have any picture in mind. Because it's unlimited. How could you have an image? Of course, exactly. Yeah. It sometimes feels tempting. Say, why do you think about something abstract? Maybe when you reduce it to physical, you can identify with it. But that, again, is a very serious error also, because you're limiting, you're destroying the whole notion of the transcendence and dissimilarity of God to his creatures.
Now, keeping these precautions in mind, can you explain to us some of the more specific divine attributes of Allah that are used by Muslims in the Quran, for instance?
Well, obviously, of course, when you talk about the attributes of Allah, you're talking about the creator. So the creation would come as one of the foremost attributes of Allah or God. This can be explained best by referring even directly to the Quran. For example, in 6:102, it says, "That is Allah, your Lord. There is no God but He, the creator of all things." Period. All things. No partner, no helper.
Right.
In the Quran, we also find that creation and sovereignty go hand in hand.
Yeah.
So not just create and leave, like some philosophers believe that God created the universe and then
forgot about the
forgot about it or withdrew. Not at all in Islam. In the Quran, we read, "Ala lahu al-khalq wal-amr." That's in 7:53. Is it not His to create and to govern or command? Also in 42:12. To Him, that is to Allah, belong the keys of the heavens and the earth.
Mm-hmm.
This is one aspect of, or one fundamental attribute, if you will.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, I think at this point I'll have to stop because we have about only 1 minute left. And I'll ask you, Dr. Vedery, to join us again next week, and we'll continue with the attributes, the positive attributes, the affirmative attributes of Allah in Islam. And we hope, ladies and gentlemen, that we'll see you next week. Until then, please, if you have any questions whatsoever, whether on the episodes or their contents, or even on Islam in general, don't hesitate to write us on Islam in Focus, Post Office Box 116, Dartmouth, Nova Scotia. Until we meet you next time, God bless you. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
الله أكبر الله أكبر